Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Our show today takes us to Hollywood, where we meet an essayist, novelist and TV writer who began her career in film production, switching to writing after being influenced by the actress Jennifer Aniston. For the last 6 years, she's produced a book a year, and her latest, Daisy Jones and the Six, is based on Fleetwood Mac. It's a wild story of the highs and lows of fame. Taylor Jenkins-Reid, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're Los Angeles-based now, but that's not where you started out. So tell us about your early years.
Yeah, so I was born in Maryland in the United States, and then I moved to Massachusetts, which is really what I think of as my home. I'm from Acton, Massachusetts, which is right next to Concord, which is where the Revolutionary War started. I was always very proud of that. Like, in our town, it's always like, oh, this is where the Revolutionary War started. It's like the beginning of American history for us in so many ways. And so between that and the fact that Louisa May Alcott wrote Little Women in Concord and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, you know, the transcendentalists are all from that area of town. So I grew up with this sense of American culture in a very specific way. But I always, always wanted to move to L.A. I was like, when I found out there was a place in the country that didn't snow, I was like, why are we all here? Do you guys know there's a place where it doesn't snow? And I went to college in Boston, and then...
And you studied film.
Yeah, I studied film and television. I'm telling you, like, from the age of like 10 or 11, I was like, oh, I'm going to Hollywood. Like, people be like, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I was like, I don't know, but I'm going to Hollywood. I don't know why that was. I was just very influenced by television and movies, and I just saw what was on my TV screen, and I was like, I need to figure out how to get there. So I studied film and television at Emerson College in Boston, and then I graduated and I moved out to LA. I was 21. I knew nobody. I had actually moved out with a boyfriend, and we broke up like a month into I mean, it was just like, it was like a very, I mean, romantic in that it was the story of, like, I'm completely alone and I've started my life over and I have to figure this out here. And so I got a job in feature film casting, which I thought, okay, I found it. This is the thing. I was 21 years old. I was like, well, I've figured out what I'm doing for the rest of my life. I'm going to work in casting movies. And I did that for 4 years.
I'd love to know a little bit about the casting process. Yeah. So if you take, say, a big blockbuster movie, mm-hmm. something we've all heard of, the project only gets made, presumably, if the star names are signed up
yes.
beforehand. When you come to casting, you're not looking at that level.
That's 100% true. And that's something that when I first got into casting, I didn't totally understand. I was really surprised that every time we'd have a project come in, there was already two stars attached at the top and that we were casting everyone else. Mm-hmm. I was like, wait, I want to be involved in choosing who's the star of this movie. That seems really fun. But in general, a movie doesn't get greenlit unless they know that there are people that will star in it. So that was the first thing that I learned. And actually, the first movie I ever worked on was a movie that was not a big movie, but it was called The Guardian. And it came attached with Ashton Kutcher and Kevin Costner. And we cast everyone else. But what is cool is that there are a lot of movies that the intellectual property itself is enough to greenlight a project. And so, for instance, one of the last movies that I did was the original Iron Man. That was the first Marvel movie. My job was helping my boss figure out who was going to be Iron Man, which was one of the most, I mean, it was so gratifying. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, you start with a list of 50 men and you start working your way down until you get down to two. And then it's like, okay, it's going to be Robert Downey Jr., which was incredibly, incredibly fun, especially because now he seems like such a movie star. But back then, he was a really risky move, you know, hiring Robert Downey Jr., who had been in prison and he was trying to start his career again, you know, making that argument to the studio, like, yes, he can do it. You can assure him he's the one. It was really, really fun. And I think that is exactly why I got into casting, because for me, it was all about character. It was all about taking this character on paper. And who do you choose? Who do you sort of match with that character in order to make it 3D and make that character come to life? And so you take this idea of Tony Stark, who could have gone a number of different ways, and then you find Robert Downey Jr., who brings that character to life. And I think there's an art in matching those things. Mm. And I loved that part of it. But it's also a very stressful job with very long hours, And I sort of, toward the end of my time in casting, felt like, I love this job, but there's something that's not quite right. There's something I'm looking for that's not here. Mm. And that turned out to be writing. And I think a lot of that was because I mistook my interest in characters. I think I wanted to create characters. I thought that I wanted to be what brings them into three dimensions, but I think it was actually I wanted to be the person that creates them. Mm. That second piece of bringing them 3D, of being in casting, is such an art, I think. But it was the right art for me.
Yeah. So now, the one where Rachel changed your career.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I was in casting, and why I started taking myself seriously as someone that could potentially write a story was because, you know, I had been a fan of Friends as a teenager. And I feel like every person says that who didn't like that show was arguably one of the most popular shows in the 90s. I was obsessed with Friends to the point where my mom was like, do we have a problem? Like, Thursday nights at 8, I mean, this was also before you could TiVo anything. So it was like, I was not going to be anywhere else. Like, I was home ready to watch TV every single week. And I would program my VHS player to record episodes so I could watch them over and over. I was just completely obsessed. And Rachel was my favorite character. And so we had this day when my bosses came in and said, oh, we're going to cast a short film. And we'd never cast a short film. I was very confused why we would be doing that. And they were like, Jennifer Aniston's directing it. And I was like, hold on. Is Jennifer Aniston coming into the office? And they were like, yeah, she's coming in next week. And I just lost it. Like, my heart rate started. I mean, and I'd met famous people. Like, there were plenty of famous people I'd met. It just, she was so much more than that to me. I just admired her so much. And so I started telling all my friends. And again, like, I had moved to Los Angeles and I didn't know anyone. So I wasn't telling my friends in LA. I didn't have any. I was telling all my friends back home in Massachusetts. And so I was like, you know, Jennifer Aniston's coming into the office on Thursday or whatever it was. And all my friends were like, you have to tell us what happens. And so I experienced that day. And she came in and she introduced herself to me and we made a couple jokes and she said this or that or whatever. And I had this story of like, okay, I met Jennifer Aniston, I have to tell everybody. But I didn't want to call each individual person, so I wrote it in a story. I was like, this is the story of this day. And I sent it wide to all my friends, just as a way to tell them. But every single person wrote back, and they were like, this story's incredible. And I thought, oh, yeah, I mean, I met Jennifer Aniston, it's great. And they're like, no, the way you told this story was really great. You should be a writer. I wish that I could have seen that in myself and I didn't need someone else to sort of give me permission, but I think I needed permission. I think I needed someone else to say, hey, this is something that you'd be good at. It seemed so audacious at the time to think of myself as a creator of anything. I didn't have that, you know, I was about 22. I didn't have that confidence yet, but having someone else say that I should do it, that was enough to get me to start writing other things. And so that's how I began writing.
I really want to explore your writing, but first I just have to ask, what's she like?
Oh, yeah. You know what? She's incredibly, incredibly sweet. I will say, like, she is just as funny as you would anticipate her being, like, just off-the-cuff funny, and she's just incredibly gracious and sweet. And if she didn't glow, literally glow brighter than other people, you would think that she was just anybody, but she's so beautiful that you're like, this is obviously a famous person. Like, you even if you didn't know who she was, you'd be like, this woman is so stunningly beautiful that there's no way she's, like, a normal human being among us, that she's clearly superlative in that way.
You have another very, very key relationship in your life, and one that's been enormously encouraging. In fact, you call him your muse, and that's your husband,
yes,
Alex.
Yes. My husband was the first person to read my fiction, which I had not even finished when I showed it to him. And he and I had a very whirlwind sort of romance, and we met when I was 24 and fell deeply crazily in love and eloped very quickly. But in that very short period of time where he was my boyfriend rather than my husband, I had been working on a novel and I was about halfway done and I hadn't told anybody. And so I showed it to him and I thought, you know, it was just this small thing I was doing. And he read it and he took it very seriously and he was like, you have to finish this book. And that, again, is another example of, you know, me not feeling yet like I was ready to say, I'm a writer. I'm going to take myself seriously. I needed someone else to take me seriously. But I respected him so much because he's also a writer. and knowing that he believed in me, I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to finish this book. And so I did. And from there on, I started to be much more confident and say to people, I want to be a writer. This is what I want to do. Will you read my work? The confidence really started growing from there.
Mm-hmm. And he's been your enabler in lots of ways. I mean, letting you give up work, supporting you, doing all of the practical stuff.
Yeah. It's funny because when we met, he and I talk about it now because we've been married for almost 10 years now. In fact, next month will be 10 years. And we look back on when I was 24 and he was 23, and we got married so quickly. And it's like, how did we know that was a good idea? God bless our parents, because it made no sense. But somehow we saw something in each other. And as we've been together longer, it's become clear that there were things about each other that we didn't realize that we needed, but we needed. And I think for me, I was just a mess in a lot of ways. I hadn't grown up with money. I didn't know how to manage my money. I didn't have the confidence to announce who I wanted to be in the world. And Alex helped me become a person who took my art seriously and allowed me the time I needed to make it. And one of the big things was, you know, I finished that first book that he encouraged me to finish, and I got an agent, and it didn't sell. We went to publishers, and it was a lot of like, this is good, but no. And so my agent said I should write another book. And so I said to Alex, I would like to quit my job and take 2 months off and write a book. And he said yes. And he supported me that whole time. And the thing that's incredible about my husband is that, like, I feel like there may be a lot of people that might say yes, but they'd make you feel bad about it the whole time. Or they'd be like, well, I hope you're also taking, you know, doing all the dishes and taking out all the trash or whatever. But he's just been so encouraging and has believed in me so much that he never made me feel like this was some big sacrifice that he was making. He always made it seem like it was something he was happy to do because he thought that I was going somewhere, because he believed in my ability to do it. And I mean, that's still true today. Like, it is a lot of, you know, I'm writing a book a year. We have a 2-year-old now. I'm touring. I'm going to a lot of places. I'm talking to booksellers. You know, I've been in 7 cities in the past 3 weeks. And I go and people say, well, who's with your daughter? And it's like, her father. Her father's with my daughter. He's taking care of her day in and day out. And he's doing his own work. I'm incredibly fortunate to be able to do what I do, but I could not do it. I could not be a mom and an author at this pace without the support system that I have, and that's 100% my husband.
And I mean, the pace is, as you say, I mean, it's a book a year. It's you're cracking them out.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, there's a lot of, so much discussion these days about work-life balance, and I feel that we're all coming to the point now where it's not about saying, okay, my work is finished because it's 5 o'clock, and now it's my life. And that actually it's nicer for all of us to integrate everything, if you love your job, that is, to integrate everything all together. So so you are perhaps working at midnight, but maybe you're not working the next day.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's funny. That's something that I've really had to work on, and especially having a kid has thrown that into, you know, I've had to rebalance everything. And I think for me, it is true. Like, I am working at midnight sometimes. I'm working on a Saturday. There, I try to keep a firm sense of, you know, these are the hours that I'm at my desk, because that makes it easier to schedule when I'm with my kid or when I'm running errands. But one of the nice things about being a writer, and also one of the sometimes frustrating things about being a writer, is that a lot of times I don't even need a computer. I'm thinking. It's so much thinking, and you can do that at any time. It's funny. I have incredible jet lag right now, and my husband's here with me in London. And so we, from the hours of like 11 p.m. to 4 or 5 a.m. every night, are up, and we can't figure out why. And we're talking about the title for my new book, or we're talking about a project of his in the middle of the night. The thing that I've had to learn is that, yes, that is true, and I am working at times that are not traditional work times, so it should also be okay for me to not feel guilty if it's a Tuesday at 4 p.m. and I say, you know what, I'm going to watch an episode of TV and relax. I'm having a really hard time having it go both ways. I need to get better at saying, you know what, just because it's between the hours of 9 to 5 on a weekday doesn't mean that I have to be working if I don't have anything I have to do right now, because I'm always working during other times. But that, it's like giving myself permission to chill out is not the easiest thing.
And working across mediums too. I know that you and Alex have co-written a TV series on Hulu. You write scripts, you write novels, you write essays. When you're writing your book 6 now, all with this wonderful kind of theme of love at their core, Are you thinking, while you're writing a novel, this is how it would adapt to screen? Or are you absolutely in that form at that time?
That's a really good question. Also, because I was thinking about this with Alex, my husband, the other day. And I was like, I don't think I do. I think the answer to that is no. And he was like, are you joking? And I was like, no, I don't think I do. And he's like, you won't write a book if you can't see how it becomes a movie. And I was like, well, yeah, that's true. And he's like, so your answer is a complete lie. And I was like, oh, okay. But I think what it is that I'm really attracted to ideas that can exist in multiple mediums. I'm thrilled by that. I think they're really exciting. But once I've decided what the idea will be, and once I feel confident that, okay, it could live outside of a book somewhere, as I'm writing it as a book, it is only a book. I think that, you know, you have to think a story has multiple ways that it can be told. But I'm choosing to tell it as a book, and I need to tell it in that form and do everything to maximize its effect within those pages. When it goes on to be a movie or a TV show, if I'm adapting it, if someone else is adapting it, that's where the work comes in of adapting the story for a different medium. But as a writer writing the book, once I sit down to actually write the words, I have to forget anything else that it could be and just write it as the story that needs to be told on paper.
Well, let's look at some of those stories. So there was Forever Interrupted, which
yes.
was, it sounds pretty autobiographical,
yeah.
actually, I have to it's, say.
It is and it isn't. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
This is a young woman who elopes after a whirlwind romance.
Yeah.
And then of course, it all changes after that. No plot spoilers.
Yeah.
After I Do is, as the title would suggest, after a marriage, but this is a marriage in crisis.
Yes.
And then we go on to Maybe in Another Life, which sounds quite Sliding Doors-ish.
It's exactly Sliding Doors-ish. It's I wrote that book because I love Sliding Doors as a kid. I remember seeing the trailer and being like, I have to be at the movie theater the day that comes out. But there's some moralizing at the end of that movie. There's an idea that there's one way that's better than another way. And I was like, what if there's not? What if by the end of this, it's like, things are just different.
One True Loves, that was your book that came out in 2016.
Yes.
Again, somebody with her high school sweetheart.
Yes. Yeah. Someone with her high school sweetheart, and he is in a helicopter that goes down. And so she grieves and moves on and meets someone else and then realizes that he's alive. Yeah. That was the book that I pitched to my editor at the time. And I was like, what if I just wrote Castaway from Helen Hunt's point of view? And she was like, yes, go.
And then I guess this was kind of your big breakthrough. This is when you really came to the public's attention. And that was The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. Now, this is a fabulous book. I was just saying how much your work kind of reminds me of Valley of the Dolls and that whole kind of 70s Hollywood aesthetic. And this book very much captures that. It's about a woman with all of these husbands. Elizabeth Taylor?
Yeah, there's a lot of Elizabeth Taylor. There's a lot of Rita Hayworth, Joan Crawford, Ava Gardner, maybe even Lana Turner. I did a lot of research. The book is about a Hollywood star, and I know a lot about Hollywood. I've worked in it, and I have a degree in it. So really, for me, the research actually was reading all the stories of these actresses and making sure that I didn't inadvertently steal one of them. Was really familiarizing myself with a lot of classic Hollywood. In reading all of these women, create one woman that had little pieces of each person.
Yeah.
And so she's very much influenced by Rita Hayworth specifically. And the Liz Taylor thing, it's funny. The Seven Husbands is the most obvious tie. I didn't actually think about it in terms of that. But there's a character, Harry Cameron, in the book who's very much based on Elizabeth Taylor's relationship with Monty Cliff.
Then we come to your new book,
yes.
Daisy Jones and the Six. And again, we have a kind of real life hook to this because Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks, it's all kind of in there. This is a fantastic read. There's a little cover blurb from Reese Witherspoon. It says, I fell head over heels for Daisy and devoured this in a day. Well, I have to agree, utterly and completely. It's one of those books that just grabs you and you sit down and you don't stop until you've finished.
Thank you.
It has such momentum and is just such a good read. How pegged to Fleetwood Mac? Because it seems, again, that like you've taken inspirations from perhaps several other groups.
Exactly. I will say really almost nothing in this book that happened to Fleetwood Mac happens to Daisy Jones and the Six. It's much more about a vibe and a feeling. And, you know, there's one thing in the book that I did steal directly from Fleetwood Mac, which is that I was reading this book about their recording of Rumours, and they, I guess, had someone send cookies laced with pot to the studio and they were all eating them. And I thought, like, I just would never come up with that on my own. Like, I just don't, I'm not, like, I'm such a teetotaler and I'm such a dork in so many ways. Like, it just never would have occurred to me to, like, make pot cookies and put them, you know. So I read that and I was like, that's too good. Like, I'm just gonna directly rip that from the Fleetwood Mac story. But everything else, you know, it's, the dynamics are different. The people are different. Nothing that happens is the same. And Daisy Jones is similar to Stevie Nicks in that she's this woman in rock in the 70s that people are, you know, just hypnotized by. But her style is different. Her attitude is different. What was fun is that I love Stevie Nicks so much that I could sort of tap into my love for her and come up with someone totally different that still made me excited and enthralled the way that Stevie Nicks does.
Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely book. You've got song lyrics at the end. Did you write
one
of those? Yes,
I did. It's the most vulnerable I have felt as a writer in a really long time, because I'm not a songwriter and I don't know if they're good, and no one, like, even my editor didn't edit them. And so there's a part of me that's like, are they really bad? I don't think they are. I think they're good. But I'm not a songwriter, and I don't think musically, you know. I'm fortunate in that both my brother and my husband are musicians, and so they know that it's like my husband plays piano and guitar, and my brother plays guitar and knows a lot about music production and music history and music theory. And so I was able to take from both of them. But I was very out of my comfort zone with that. But it felt necessary to me because for me, what part of what's so great about listening to bands, especially when you know that there's some inner turmoil within the band, is how is it showing up in their lyrics, you know? And so I wanted people to see what Daisy and Billy, the two songwriters in the book, I wanted them to see what Daisy and Billy are saying. And then see what shows up in the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And are they being honest? Are they copying to exactly how they felt? Because this is the art that they made in the 70s. This is what they were saying to each other. This is what they were writing together in 1978. So, you know, I think there's some reading between the lines that can happen. You know, part of what's so great about Rumours isn't just that it's a great album, but that you're listening to it and going, is he really saying that about her? Mm. You know, or did he mean it that way? Or is that what this lyric meant?
And you had those two couples, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So interesting. Now, you have a Spotify playlist
Yes.
that goes with this, but these are not your songs. So when are you going to get your brother and your husband
I
to
know.
Put music to your lyrics?
I know. I've thought this before. The problem, as I see it, is that I wouldn't even know how to instruct them what it should sound like. I would be like, make this sound like Bruce Springsteen. And they'd be like, I can't do that. It'll be interesting, though, because it is going to be a show. It is going to be a TV show for Amazon. And one of the things that's most exciting to me, obviously the casting is exciting coming from a casting world. I'm very excited to see, like, who plays Daisy, who plays Billy.
Wow, yeah.
But also, you know, who's going to make these songs and what are they going to sound like? I'm in that way, I'm sort of first in line to be a fan and just say, like, what does it sound like? I don't know what it sounds like. I wrote the song, but I don't know what it sounds like. So I'm excited for someone to show me what that song sounds like.
Oh, I'm so excited to see it on the screen too. But I do wonder about that, because when you're so invested in a book and then suddenly it's there and it's not what's in your head.
Yeah.
I mean, for you as the writer, that must be doubly difficult.
You know, I've been down this road a few times. We've gotten a lot of my stuff has been adapted. It hasn't been produced yet, but, you know, I've read screenplays. I'm pretty good at this point divorcing myself from the art that's made based on my book. I know that I didn't make that. So if I love it, that's that much more exciting because it's something outside of myself and I didn't make it. If I don't love it, that's okay. I will say I've read the pilot that for the TV series and I've read the character breakdown, and it's amazing. I was just blown away by it. So I'm trying to keep my expectations realistic, but they are getting a little bit high. I think that the people that I've chosen to work with are incredible and really good at their jobs. So I'm very excited to see what they come up with.
Now, you are, in a way, the ultimate Hollywood insider. As you say, you even have a degree in it.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of your work is, not only do we see this theme of love the whole way through, but you return to fame quite often. And I wonder if that's something that attracts you personally. Was that the draw to Hollywood? Do you want to be famous, or are you somebody that just stands back?
I do not want to be famous. Absolutely not. I think you're right. I think that for me, fame is the people that we choose to make famous in a society tell us so much about the things that we value. And I've always been fascinated by that. Who are the people that we're drawn to, and what does that say about us? And I think as you look at the way the famous changed over the past couple of decades, we are seeing how our society is changing. I'm really fascinated by the fact that we no longer have traditional movie stars, you know, that Tom Cruise is the last Tom Cruise, and the way that we're diversifying our interests. Influencers on Instagram are perhaps, you know, have more power over their followers than certain movie stars do. Just in my lifetime, the way that our society regards famous people has changed. So I think part of what I'm so drawn to with fame is not just what it says about us, but also, you know, what it does to the people that we elevate. I think it's very difficult, I think, to have that much attention on you and to have that much expectation put on you.
Taylor Jenkins Reid, you may not want to be famous. I fear that once this book comes out, you may have absolutely no choice. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Daisy Jones and the Six is published by Hutchinson. It's by Taylor Jenkins Reid. You've been listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin, and many thanks to the production team of Sarah Miles, George McDonough, Christy Evans, Mariana Legrasta, and Gabrielle DeLisanti. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.